Cultural fault lines exist in healthcare with clashing moral traditions, principles, values, and beliefs. That's according to Michael Brannigan, the FAP Endowed Chair in Ethics and Moral Values at the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York. His most recent book is entitled Cultural Fault Lines in Healthcare, Reflections on Cultural Competency, and he joins us now on the Bioethics Channel. Michael, in your book, you talk about healthcare institutions and how they've responded to addressing these cultural fault lines by incorporating cultural competency guidelines and regulations. In your mind, is that working? Are we making progress in that regard?
Mm-hmm. All right. Good question, Laurel, and thanks for having me on your program. First of all, yes, definitely there's progress. I mean, definitely there's an awareness, an increasing awareness among healthcare institutions about the differences that we face when we have patients from other cultures, no doubt about that. And there's an increasing awareness of the need to be more aware and more knowledgeable of these cultures. So I would say, yes, there's progress. However, you know, the other side of the coin is that a lot of these efforts only go so far. And that's what I argue in my book. To begin with, cultural competency, the term itself, has become pretty much of a buzz phrase. And in the first couple of chapters in the book, I explore more closely what cultural competency means, because what we don't have is a sufficient philosophical, conceptual unpacking of the notion of cultural competency. So I examine the notion of culture, and then I examine the notion of competency. And from that, I sort of arrive at the tentative conclusion that we still have a long way to go. And cultural competency, in essence, is not simply about knowing a lot about another culture. You can have a shopping list of cultural features, traits, dispositions, etc., but that's not really enough. And what I stress especially is that so much depends upon the attitudes and the skills that we have in communicating with our patients. So, yes, in response to your question, yes, there's progress, but we still have a long way to go, just like the Red Sox. You know, we've had a bad start to the season, but we still have over 100 games left.
Yeah, there you go.
Hopefully we can get there.
Well, we should say for our audience here is that Michael used to be at the Center for Practical Bioethics, and he's a big Red Sox fan, and I'm a big Cardinal fan, and so in 2004, that was an interesting time for both of us.
That's true.
Now, yeah. You say something about a buzz phrase when it comes to cultural competency, and I guess it would be a range there of where it's something to check off to get accreditation for your hospital, as an example, rather than delving deeply into the health issues of a particular patient from a different culture. Do you find that to be the case?
Yes, definitely. There's a section I talk about this, the notion of reification. And that's one of the hurdles that we face. And reification comes about when we take a particular term and we stultify it. We make it sort of thing-like. And in this case, the more buzz-like, the more politically correct a term becomes, the more reified it becomes, where in essence, the notion is quite dynamic. Cultural competency is a very dynamic notion. But that's not the only buzz term. I mean, hospital ethics committees, at first, you know, I'm of the opinion that they may have originated for many reasons, but one reason certainly was to alleviate any further litigation. But as we know, we've had more ethics committees in hospitals now. Another term is organizational ethics, another buzz term. So when you look at a hospital ethics committee, there are so many things on its plate. And when you have another additional requirement that accreditation reinforces, such as cultural competency, that gets added to the plate of concerns. But what happens is that we dilute our understanding of it, and we don't explore it sufficiently. So yes, in your response, it has become a buzzword, along with others.
What about then hospitals who, you know, to be honest, they're making a good faith effort to meet the needs of cultural competency, and they have professionals available, interpreters available to speak the language of patients who need it. Is that a good first step, or is there a lot more that we need to do?
Well, that's a good step. Definitely, it's a good first step. It's important to have interpreters rather than translators. Translators can transliterate a particular phrase or a sentence for a patient, but the interpreter goes deeper in terms of getting the sense, the orientation, the particular disposition that not only the patient but the family member has as well. So interpreters are very important. I had a conversation about that recently about phone interpreters. And that's all well and good. And a lot of hospitals, because of all kinds of constraints, they may not have sufficient numbers of interpreters, and they have available phone interpreters. And that's good. However, what's lacking in that is the face-to-face encounter with the patient. You see, and that's a point that I stress, especially in a book, is the need for more interpersonal face-to-face engagement with our patients, what I call presence. So, interpreters are important. Uh-huh.
Let's talk about your idea of presence. You talk about how we've become more screen-centric, using your word, with Facebook and technology providing the channel for communication rather than authentic face-to-face engagement. And that's an issue not just for cultural, but for anyone, I suppose.
Yeah, that's what I think is that our healthcare system is very much a reflection of our cultural ethos and our cultural values. And in our culture, as you well put it, our society and culture is getting much more familiar or comfortable, I suppose, with communicating via technological means. So right now, the conversation we're having now is on the phone and Skyping, and that's great. However, the problem lies, and there's always a trade-off, the problem lies in whether or not we think of this type of communication not only replacing or substituting for communication face-to-face, but actually being better than the communication that we can have face-to-face. And I argue, along with many others, is that that ought not to be the case. That's not true. Real communication in the genuine full sense requires an embodied presence with each other, whereby you and I can read our faces, we can read our body language, where there is silence. You can read in my tone of voice, or all of these things that that are missing in the sort of digital communication that we need to.
Well,
does that make sense?
Yeah, it really does. And around the idea of presence is how to address the chasm, as you put it, the widening chasm between our concerns and those of the other, someone who looks differently and acts differently. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, you know, when we look at cultural competency on the most basic level, we think of working with patients from other cultures, not just patients, by the way, Laurel, but also healthcare providers from other cultures, all right, because more and more hospitals have physicians who are from other countries and other backgrounds. So we often think of cultural competency on that very basic level. But digging deeper, cultural competency really has to do with what's at issue here is what I call the original fault line. And the original fault line is the fault line between me, myself, my sense of who I am, and the other particularly as a person who tends to be marginalized or feels disenfranchised from the healthcare system. Now, that other is not necessarily a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Muslim. That other can be a patient in our own city or town, an Hispanic patient who feels marginalized. So that's the original fault line, the philosophical notion of this tension that exists. It's a natural tension between our sense of who we are individually and our relationship with the other. So that's the original fault line. And cultural competency work, therefore, this is why I argue very strongly that the first step in cultural competency work is not necessarily coming up with interpreters. That's all well and good. But the first step is knowing the kind of cultural biases we each bring to the bedside. We have to, in other words, there's a sort of self-examination that's required, because what I bring to the bedside when I speak with a patient, there are a set of unaware, unconscious biases that derive from my cultural upbringing. So I have to be aware of them. That's very, very important.
What about your call that the healthcare community must become a voice for the different cultures that are coming through our healthcare system, and how that, I think, is challenging a healthcare system that's big, and sometimes how they put things together is for the convenience of the organization rather than for the people that they are treating or trying to provide healthcare to. There must be a voice there. Is that what you're calling for?
Absolutely. Healthcare institutions are working very hard to become more trustworthy. They have hospital ethics committees. They have compliance programs, etc. And these, and you know, one of the great things that I've learned from my work there in Kansas City was that there are numerous dedicated healthcare professionals, physicians, nurses, social workers, psychiatrists, clergy, hospital ethics committee members, and it was a great learning experience for me, because it made me more aware that there are people who are truly dedicated to working in the best interests of patients and working to alleviate their suffering. Therefore, we don't hear too much about that. We hear in the news a lot of the negatives, and it's very important that there are many, many committed professionals out there. So therefore, we have these deliberate institutional efforts to be more trustworthy. However, being trustworthy does not necessarily guarantee that the public will place their trust in the institution. Trustworthiness and the placing of trust are not the same. As philosopher Honora O'Neill, who argues that point, she's an English philosopher, but there's a distinction between trustworthiness, such as institutional traction and hospital policies, like medical futility, etc. Trustworthiness is not the same as the actual placing of trust on the part of the public. So what we have to do as healthcare providers is we can only work within our own sphere. We can't change the system. So I think this is where presence comes in. We can only work within our own sphere with our patients. And if we can somehow individually show them in the best way we can, and with that little time that we have, because you're right, they're increasingly terribly constraining time constraints. In that little time we have to show them that we truly care for them, that sends a message that transcends all cultures, you see, and that makes a big difference in how that patient will or will not place their trust in us. So even though there may be a lack of trust in the healthcare system or institution, what we hope to gather is, again, is having them trust us individually as healthcare professionals. But cultivating that presence is a challenge given today, you know, all the pressures that we face in the system, in the institution.
You close your introduction by calling yourself a philosopher by passion and quoting Epicurus, "Vain is the discourse of that philosopher by whom no human suffering is healed." That's the ideal goal here, is it not? Healing human suffering?
That to me is our aim as humans, not just philosophers. Our aim as human beings is to work in ways that we can to relieve, alleviate another person's suffering. That's what it's all about. In other words, closing that gap between the original fault line, between myself and the other. I use a bit of Buddhist teachings in the book, And this is more endemic in Buddhist teachings because they recognize that there's less of an ontological gap or distance between the self and the other. But in our Western culture, we uphold that distinction. But you're absolutely right. I believe that that's what we're all about, is to relieve suffering, not just the suffering of humans, but the suffering of all living creatures. That's our call. And, you know, when all is said and done, when you look back, when I look back at my life, I like to at least have said that, well, I've at least worked in that direction. It's not how many books one writes, or it's not how hard one works. It's all about the connections that we make and how we can make a lift or relieve the burdens of others.
The book is called Cultural Fault Lines in Healthcare, Reflections on Cultural Competency. The author is Michael Branigan. He is the Pfaff Endowed Chair in Ethics and Moral Values at the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York. My name is Laurel LeBoux. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.